Podcast Studios is the home of Head Stuff Podcasts. It's where lots of our shows are recorded and where we work on production, promotion, video, live shows, and lots more. In our studios here in Dublin City Centre, we work with everyone from international brands to government organisations, charities to arts groups, entrepreneurs to hobbyists. So if you'd like us to help tell your story in a creative, professional and engaging way, you can find out more at thepodcaststudios.ie.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Basically. I'm your host, Stephanie Preisner, and today with me in studio I have a man called Kieran Lally, who is from Mayo, who has climbed Mount Everest, which to me is a fascinating story. Kieran, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to the very start. When did Everest come on your radar as something you wanted to do? Were you always into hiking? Like, how did this all start?
Wow. Well, there's always a good few hills knocking around Mayo.
So yeah.
You'd have a
few times up Kirkpatrick, like.
You'd have a bit of a vantage point for some of them, yeah. And I think then when my wife and I were travelling, Nepal was one of our destinations, and Mount Everest Base Camp was definitely a destination. And then I think we began to, when we were there, you look up at this thing and you appreciate that it's one of the world's great challenges. And so it gets into your head.
Did you do base camp?
We did base camp when my wife and I, when we were traveling around the world.
Okay. And did you have to train for that, or did you just do it as a whim?
Well, we were young and we were fit at the time.
Okay.
And we're pretty okay. It'd be about 5,500 meters in height. And we would not be in a hurry. We'd stay in a local village and we'd move on to the next village that'd be a bit higher, and so on and so on. And eventually you get there and it opens up your mind to what possibilities.
And is it called base camp? Because it's the that's where you start the actual climb to Mount Everest. Why is it called base camp?
Well,
because base camp to me gives the illusion that it's the bottom, but that's the sort of the top that a lot of people get to.
It's the beginning of the more serious stuff.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you're sort of starting when you get there. But then again, on that occasion, it was our destination.
Right, okay.
And it was wonderful that we felt really proud of ourselves having got there. And but you don't need any serious equipment to get there. Beyond that point, your equipment must improve. You'd need your crampons and your you need, the insulation needs to improve a little bit as well.
Do you have Sherpas helping you up base camp, or do they only go up to the top of Everest with you?
You'd manage on your own to go without any help or guidance to get to base camp. There'd be enough information available. You'll fly into Kathmandu, and basically at the time we got a bus that took about 14 hours to the village, and you get off this bus on the side of the road and somebody directs you to a path, and the path leads off into the mountain, and you start walking along the path.
But there's loads of people doing it, and it's kind of like a pilgrimage more than a...
Yeah. Well, if you do the bus thing, it'll be more like there'll be less people. A lot of people fly to Lukla and carry on from there. So you don't have to walk in. We decided we'd do the walk in because we were sort of up for it at the time.
Right.
And it was adventure. We were just seeking adventure, really.
So you come home from base camp and you're all proud of yourself, but you've now seen the top of Mount Everest.
I got bitten, yeah.
Right, okay.
I got the bug, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, but then at that time, we'd spent about 3-4 months traveling, and we came home and we're sort of into our relationship, and we sort of got married and got a mortgage and...
Distracted by the sensible things in life.
I'm afraid. Yeah. The grindstone took over, and then a number of years later, I think we just sort of got an itch, probably midlife crisis or something. And
just you or both of you?
More me.
Right, okay. Your poor wife.
Now, we went back. My wife and I went back and went to Nepal again after that, a good few years after that. And we did what they call the Annapurna Circuit, which is a really beautiful thing to do as well. But quite a number of years, I can't say I remember the exact year. I went down, then I did Kilimanjaro because I was a good bit older and I didn't know. I wanted to test myself, see had I still got anything in the tank. I was happy with the way that went, and that kept me satisfied for a while.
Right.
And but a couple of years go by, and the feet gets itchy again, and my eyes went towards a mountain in Georgia and Russia called Elbrus, and that would have more snow and ice on it, and
than Everest,
than
Kilimanjaro,
Sorry, yes. Yeah, and so if you have any notion of going height, you need a little higher, you need a little bit of experience with the ice and the snow and all that type of stuff. So that supplied that. But it was similar in height to Kilimanjaro. So again, that went well because altitude wouldn't have been a problem. And then another few years go by and I cast my eyes towards Argentina, and there's a mountain down there by the name of Aconcagua. At this stage, then you're going through the summits, the seven summits. Kilimanjaro is the highest in Africa. The seven summits basically is the highest mountain in each continent. And Georgia, they call the one in Georgia the highest one in Europe. And even though people say Mount Blanc is, but apparently for reasons of the seven summits, it's Elbrus. And then South America is Aconcagua. And but that's up at around 7,000 meters. And this was, hadn't been anything close to that. And
just for context, like what's Kirkpatrick or Carrantool, which is the highest in Ireland?
Carrantool is about 1,000 meters and 1,010 meters. I think it's 1,010 meters, but in around 1,000 meters, yeah.
So, and that's the highest in Ireland?
That's the highest in Ireland, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Right,
Kerry,
okay.
The down in Kerry, isn't it? Yeah. And
so you're up at 7,000 now in South America?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at even though you're in South America, which, you know, people will imagine as kind of tropical and, you know, rainforesty, at 7,000 meters, it's just going to be snow, right?
It's good. There isn't a tremendous amount of snow on it. Depending on the time of year, but it doesn't hold glaciers or
right,
it doesn't
okay.
hold snow all year round. But it's a tough climb. It's basically... It's the highest mountain in the world outside of the Himalayas.
Right, okay.
Right. So when you do that one, you can now start thinking more serious stuff in the Himalayas. Like, I mean, I'd be sort of methodical and I'd do it step by step. More people sort of go straight in.
Jump in, yeah.
Yeah.
Those people end up dying on the mountain.
Well, I don't know. I'm quite sure a lot of them are quite successful. But...
And in these ones, that when you're doing the seven summits, like, are you with a group? Are you on your own? Do you have... porters and Sherpas helping you up, or is it different on each one?
Each one is different, but basically what it would really come down to, the economics of the country would dictate as to how much help you'd have.
Right.
Basically, if labour is cheap, you'll have a lot of help.
Yes.
Okay. And in the Himalayas, labour isn't all that expensive.
So there's a lot of help there.
You have good help there. And the Sherpas are top class. They're really, really good. They do know the stuff. They live at altitude and they know their stuff. Like, I mean, the Sherpas will live at 3,000 meters plus. So like, I mean, here, you wouldn't be thinking about a site on top of Carrantool.
Yeah.
1,000 meters. But these guys are living happily enough in villages and at 3,000 meters, yeah. Or thereabouts anyway.
So... what's the preparation for Everest like then?
Well, people say fit, but I'd say strong. You just get strong. Basically, lots of hiking. You carry weight when you're hiking, and gym work won't hurt.
Do you have to learn how to climb, how to use those crampons? Like, it's the fittest person in the world. Like, do they need actual mountain climbing training?
You'd need to skill up. But like, a lot of these mountains are not hugely technical. Okay. Like when you're not going up sheer faces or anything like that, like when you traverse around it, you find the.
So it's like kind of walking, but in intense.
Walking uphill, high altitude. Yeah. Scrambling, maybe. There'd be some climbing, of course, but like, I mean, there wouldn't be.
And how do you know what to bring with you or who, like, who
you'd tells
be,
you'd be well guided and all of that. Basically, back to your other question, how's it done? That, like everything else, all these things now are commercialized.
But yes, okay.
Basically, there was always, like, I mean, back in the day, there was always somebody organizing it. Like, I mean, the first British expeditions, French expeditions, they were all organized. And there was always a head guy organizing. Getting labor, organizing tents, and the climbers were more elite, and they were a pretty privileged bunch, really. And today, then you pay your money and you go, you join a group. That's pretty much it, and everything is pretty much organized for you.
Your food, your tent is pitched.
The tent is carried up. You make it from camp to camp. That'll be ready for you. You don't do an awful lot of carrying. You do some, of course. Well, it depends on how much you want to pay out.
Right, okay.
You can pay to have everything done for you if you want.
It's very expensive to climb Mount Everest, isn't it? Like 65?
You can pay 65, and you'd have a lot done for that 65. You wouldn't need to carry a lot.
Right.
You'd be well looked after at 65. But if you come down to around the 30, you'd have to do a little bit more yourself. And that'd be more my budget.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And how long? Okay, so you do base camp first and then you set off from base camp. Do you have to spend a bit of time getting used to the altitude, or what does it actually look like once you're like, okay, I'm heading to Nepal, I'm going to climb Mount Everest?
Well, walking into base camp, you should learn a good bit about the altitude if you haven't done it before. It'd be a really good experience. What you'll discover even on the way to base camp is that you must acclimatise, and that would consist of basically resting up at one of the villages for a night without gaining further height, and then your body will adjust, and it basically will create more red blood cells.
Okay.
And it's really all about the red blood cell count. The oxygen thins out, and blood cells that brings
carry the oxygen
around your body. So if the oxygen is low, you'll increase the number of blood cells, and that'll make up for the lack of oxygen in the air. And you'll learn that en route to base camp. But as you go higher, then basically what we did was we rested up at base camp for a couple of days and let the body adjust at that height. And then before you did go too far further, you'd climb up to maybe 6,000 meters. At that point, you're tricking the body into producing more even further extra blood cells again.
And is there a physical impact on your body with that extra blood set, with those extra blood cells? Like, do you feel dizzy? Do you feel bloated? Like, what's the impact on the body?
The impact at this point, the body is struggling. And the reason it struggles is down to the lack of oxygen. And the reason that in turn tells the body to produce the red blood cells. God, this is good.
I'm just saying, you don't have to get too scientific about
you're
it.
You're not going to get there without the effort. Like, I mean, you can't trick the body into the producing the red blood cells without going up the mountain and gasping for air.
But is there not some sort of medical risk there? Like, is someone looking after you? Are they looking at your blood oxygen levels? Or are you just going to, I'm just going to go until I drop?
Some people go until they drop, but you should be able to tell. Like, I mean, you could get a headache, you could get sick, you could vomit, you could whatever.
And at that point, you just go, I'm not going any further.
You just say, There's always a sharp eye, keeping an eye on things. A lot of these sharp lads are a bit like shepherds, and we're the sheep, you know.
Right. Okay.
And if the leader, there'll always be a team leader. As a rule, there'll be a team leader, and his job is to keep an eye on the guy that'll set up. He mightn't be walking in a straight line anymore. He might be doing some little telltale slip. He might, there's all those telltale signs. Even if you yourself, you can get to the point where you won't recognize the fault yourself. If you've gone too far and the altitude sickness is kicking in, you mightn't recognize it yourself. No.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you the leader would need to kick in then at that point and just say, hey, you're off. You're out of here, bucko.
So how, first of all, like we'll go through the journey, but how long does it take from base camp to the top?
From base camp to the top would take about a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it'd be to get to base camp would take about between a week and 2 weeks.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Depending on how slow you can take that bit at your own pace, but
it depends on your starting point. Really? Okay. Yeah, 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 yeah.
A month to climb.
Well, basically, again, see, you're going up and down. Again, like...
So you climb up and then you come back down to sleep.
You come back down. You climb up, trick the body into saying, hey, I need more red blood cells. So then you come down, you might stay at base camp again for 2 days, and then you climb up and then you pitch your tent at the one at 6,000 because you've already been there mm-hmm. and you've tricked the body into thinking that. So now all of a sudden you can stay at 6,000 because you have enough blood cells to do so.
Right.
Then after that, you push on, you go up to another camp, right? We'll say, camp one is at 6,000 for argument's sake. And then we'd say you push on another 500 meters to camp two. And then you come back down to camp one and go back up to camp two after a rest. And then you go to camp three, which is at 7,000 meters. And then.
So you just visit 7,000 meters and then that night you'd stay back down.
We stayed overnight for two nights. We stayed 2 nights at 7,000 meters so that our bodies would acclimatize to that.
And what are you doing at 7,000, like at those heights for 2 days?
Well, you'd be melting ice and drinking tea. And it takes so up at the altitude, it takes everything. Like, I mean, your movement is so slow. Your pace, your mind slows down, your body slows down. Even the water takes longer to boil because there isn't enough oxygen for the little gas stove. You're there waiting for this ice to melt so you can drink something and maybe make a cup of tea or something. And you're just hanging. You're just hanging.
But is there enjoyment in that? Is it kind of meditative? Like, yeah, I cannot relate.
You're not moving and you're not gasping. It's great. You're just sitting there. And
sitting there in the freezing cold, waiting for
water. You're pretty well wrapped up here now. Wrapped up. And the sun does shine. And when the sun is out, it catches you. And it's nice and warm at nighttime when the sun is in. It can be. But at that stage, you'd be, the gear is pretty good, like.
Yeah,
like,
okay. I mean, it has to be.
If you're not up, if you're up there in the gear and you're cold, you're really
in trouble.
Yeah, you just forget that. You just have to have the gear.
Right.
Yeah, you shouldn't be cold.
So you're chatting to other people, eating. Are people cooking food for you?
No, you'd be cooking your own there now. On that
right,
one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have like multiple snacks? How big is your backpack? What?
Well, a lot of the time, again, like, I mean, that tent was put in place for us by the Sherpas. So we carried up our food and any clothing that we might want for the time, which basically is just a sleeping bag, really, because you wear most of what you need
for a month, like, and you're not obviously there's no washing machines, obviously there's no showering.
We're back to the laundry. Yeah, the laundry is always interesting at that point. Yeah.
That's so okay. Anyway,
so
you're up at 7,000 feet, and at what point? So what's the rest of the journey like? Like, what are the...
Well, at 7,000 metres, that's the point where you start. When you go beyond that, you start using oxygen. So that was the interesting thing about Aconcagua in Argentina, was that I now knew that I was at the point, I could get to the point where I would have oxygen if I went further to aid me.
Okay.
Right? So I knew I had achieved that.
So you knew could do that 7,000 meters.
I knew I could get to the point where oxygen would supplement my effort to go further, to go to camp four, and camp four would be the rest over place before you strike out for the top and the summit.
Right. Okay.
So I knew where I was at this point.
And the oxygen, are we talking like oxygen tank, like a scuba diver would have, or?
It wouldn't be as heavy as that. It'd be the scuba doesn't weigh in the water. So, but this would weigh. So it's very light aluminium oxygen content. Yeah.
And is it full time, like you're breathing it in, or just as you need it, like an inhaler almost? Or are you actually breathing through it all the time?
You're breathing through it all the time. It just goes through the mask.
Right, okay.
And you pick it up as it goes. You set it at a very low volume, a very low volume of oxygen goes past your lips, and you breathe it in, and it mixes in your mask, and you breathe that in.
That day when you get the oxygen for the first time and you're heading to Camp 4, like, does it feel like a big relief to be like, oh, this is nice?
A lot of the time then what you'll do is, even when you rest and sleep, you'll rest with the oxygen on, because mm-hmm. oxygen is strength. Oxygen gives you the power and the strength too.
Stay alive. It's a pretty crucial element, as far as I know.
It gets. That's one of the things, I have to say this now for the crack, is that you asked what would you be doing for, you know, just you're sitting there and you have these fantastic views. Like, I mean, it's, the Himalayas are just king, really. They're just incredible, because the view you have is just mountain after mountain, and they're all white peaked, and they're just seem to go on forever and ever, and you're there and you have your little oxygen bottle on you, and you look out and you say, hey, I'm away above anything that's habitable here. And you begin to realize, hey, most of us are living down in the first mile. Like, I mean, in Ireland we all live below 500 meters or 400 meters. Mm-hmm. And you're up there, you're standing on the side of this thing that's 7,000 meters up, and you look down and you have this incredible, how will I call it, concept of the world and what it is and perhaps how it works. And you're so conscious of the oxygen, because what's on your back is supplying it to you. And then you think, what are we doing with the planet? Like, you know, mm-hmm. we're destroying anything that produces oxygen. We can't wait to cut it down. And you're obviously going to think of Brazilian rainforests and whatever else not that the want to burden, and you're there sort of gasping for this oxygen that's so precious. And you began to actually see the planet and this little tiny film of breathable air that surrounds it, and we're ruining it. We're making a complete ass of it.
And do you get, like, in those moments, you just get kind of like annoyed at the earthlings who are beneath you? Or are you kind of like...
all those people busy down in their habitat, yeah.
Or do you get sort of inspired to do something when you come back down? Or how does it...
For that moment you're down there, and of course you've got this... I'll call it, I don't know how to call it, it's might be fantasy land, well it is fantasy land, this, all those superior thoughts about how things should be done and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But of course a month or two later you're back down in the middle of it again, and you're just adding to it,
back same down as everybody else. Yeah. Getting fruit wrapped in plastic.
And you just got back on the grindstone and you do what you do, and you make another few bobs, so you might be able to go off and somewhere else again.
Taking a break from the show to tell you about our sponsor, humdingermortgages.ie, your new gaff without the faff. Humdinger are an award-winning mortgage brokerage, and they specialise in finding the right mortgage for you. The best part is that you deal with the broker and they deal with every major bank in the Irish market, so you don't have to trawl around talking to loads of people. They also make the best recommendation on what's the best way to proceed for you specifically, and they stay at your side to help you at every step of the way, from application to drawing down your mortgage. They're in the mortgage business, right? Not the application business. They have absolutely no interest in putting you through the ringer and getting you to fill out loads of forms without getting a mortgage at the end. And they're really honest from the get-go about what the problems might be with your application. But then they don't abandon you. They will stay by your side and give you the best advice on how to make sure that you are successful the next time you apply. They specialise in helping first-time buyers, people looking to trade up, and people like me who are looking to save ourselves some money by switching our mortgage for a better rate. And like for me, I'm going to switch my mortgage. I'm working with Humdinger because, like, a reduction of even 0.5% on my mortgage rate can save me like 30 grand in interest over the whole term of my mortgage. Mortgages are the biggest financial decision you are ever going to make, so take advantage of speaking to experts and go to humdingermortgages.ie to begin your journey. So while I have you, I'm going to take the opportunity to take you hostage for a minute and tell you about the merchandise that we are selling. We have notebooks and pens, which are branded with the Basically branding, and you should buy them. You should buy them because it's a lovely notebook. Who doesn't need a notebook? If you are a Headstuff podcast member, if you buy the notebook, you get the pen for free. It supports me, it supports the podcast, it supports the producers, the people who work on the show, and means that we can continue to make these podcasts and give them to you
for free. If you want to become a Head Stuff podcast member, if you get a lot from the podcast and you think, God, I'd like to support Stephanie and the podcast, you can become a Head Stuff podcast member for €5 plus VAT. Or you can give more if you want to. Go to headstuffpodcast.com and you can click register there. And you pick a podcast. You can pick up to three podcasts, or you can pick just one podcast. Say you pick my podcast, then you'll get my bonus material for free and all of the bonus material for all of the other podcasts on the network. So it's a really, really good deal. €5, all of these special podcasts. So if you want to do that, do it. I'll be very, very grateful. The people who are in the community, the Head Stuff podcast members, are my favourite people. They support the podcast. They mean that you can listen to this podcast for free. It's €5 a month. I'm going to stop talking now, but I really appreciate your support. Thank you.
The podcast studios are opening their doors to everyone this culture night. Come see the place where your favourite Head Stuff podcast network shows are made. Get behind the scenes access, learn about production, and record your very own 5-minute podcast. This is an opportunity not to be missed. Join us Friday the 23rd of September. Register on eventbrite.ie or see the Culture Night website for more details. We look forward to seeing you there.
And what? How is your wife in all this? Because my husband recently climbed Kilimanjaro and I really struggled with the fact that his phone, you know, was like intermittent and I couldn't get in touch with him and I didn't know if he was dead and I was Googling all the people who've ever died in Kilimanjaro. Like, do you have any contact with her for that month? How does she know that you're alive?
I bought a little, how will I call it, a cheapy phone in Kathmandu. So I'd have the local service and linked up there. And we texted, we communicated. The company Summit Climb was quite good with this communications.
Right, okay.
And the other thing is because when we were traveling back in the day, we'd no contact at all. Like, I mean, there's no mobile phones.
Yeah, so you're kind of more used to it.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, we were just like, I mean, we were out of contact for months, really.
Right. But you were together at that point.
We were together, but nobody else had a contact. Had
for
any
you.
Contact with us.
Yeah.
You might find some phone somewhere in some city and you'd phone home and say, hey, I'm still here. We're in Kathmandu now, or we're in Bombay now, or we're in Calcutta now, or Bangkok now, or something like that. And you'd always send postcards with the most obscure address you could possibly find. yeah, that was always fun putting the address on.
So what's the last camp, 7?
No, the last camp is 4.
Four, sorry. And then
you're thinking of the 7 summits. So back to 7,000 metres and camp 3, right? Well, then, and again, back to Aconcagua in Argentina. My next step then was I wanted to climb something that was similar in height to camp 4, which is at more or less 8,000 metres.
Right.
And then I did that via Choyu in Tibet. And that was the year of the Icelandic volcano.
Yes, 2010.
That slowed everything down. And we had 6 weeks in which the plan was to have 6 weeks, but the volcano narrowed that down to 5 weeks. And as a result, the acclimatization process was hurried and we didn't have as much time to acclimatize as you'd really need to. So it became this fantastic struggle. We were always climbing with less, not quite fully prepared, not quite fully acclimatized, because we had to have the deadline of or the window when things were okay at the top.
Right, okay.
So that was a massive struggle. That really put
people under pressure.
I swore I'd never climb again after it. I found it so difficult. And but of course, it's like everything else.
You forget about it.
Yeah.
And so how did you talk to me about summit? Like, I know on Kilimanjaro, you summit sort of over one night.
Yeah.
But obviously with Everest, camp 4.
Well, then you make it to camp 4. You go up from camp, you go up your whatever number of meters it is from camp 3 to camp 4. And you've got your oxygen and then you stay at camp 4. Now, the choice was for us was that you've got about 4 or 5 hours rest and then you push on again, or you make that, you stay an extra day and you have 30 hours rest at camp 4.
Okay.
And you while you're there, you'll be breathing oxygen all through that. Our leader, Dan Masur, recommended that we go for the 30 hours rest.
Yeah, and then that's what I would choose.
And then we pushed on. And from that point, it is about... the way they work it is that around between 12 and 14 hours you give yourself to get back to Camp 4. Now,
so you get up and back in 12 to 14 hours?
Correct. Now, you don't want to go beyond 14, right? Okay. So you're going to say, okay, 10 up, 4 down, right? Yeah. It might be 9 up and 4 down, right? Whatever, it doesn't matter. But once you hit the 10, if you haven't summited by 10 hours...
You have to turn around.
It's best turn around. You're pushing it. You're gone beyond.
Because the air is so thin up there, or it's so cold, or why?
You'll have your energy. You won't have enough, what they call enough in the tank. You won't have enough energy. If you push on after 10 hours, they're afraid that you won't make it back. There won't be enough left. You'll not have enough power, enough energy, enough strength to get back down.
Okay.
So there is what they call this the turnaround point. And that's always that's the huge thing is to make it within that safe deadline.
How long did it take you to get up?
It took me around, I was up and down, I think, in about 12 hours.
Right. How long did you stay at the top once you got there?
We hung around there. We had a beautiful, beautiful day, our morning when we were there. So we hung around for about 40 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
How many meters are we at now?
You'd be...
At the top?
At the top is 8848.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, 8848.
8848.
Yeah. Yeah.
God almighty.
Yeah.
And what are you thinking at the top? Like what?
I made it. I made it. I can't believe it. I made it. And
is it overwhelming?
It's, there's a lot of relief.
Right.
Because you really want to make it. Like, I mean, people...
There'd be nothing worse now than having to turn around when you can see the top, do you know?
People have had to do that. And there is the fear of failure. There's a huge, like, I mean, you just want, well, personally, I wanted that Mayo flag on top of Everest. I just wanted that so bad.
As right. Someone who's married to a Mayo man, I can understand.
You're getting, I couldn't.
Was it the first Mayo flag that's ever been up there?
Yes.
Did you think you were going to break the curse by going up there?
I put it up there with all those Tibetan prayer flags, and that September I sat in Crow Park and I watched the Mayo Miners. I forget who they were playing, but they won the All-Ireland, the Mayo Miners.
The Miners. Come on now.
Hey, come on. They are now the present team.
They still haven't won. Sam Maguire.
Yeah, and they did win, right? And I was already, I said, that's one of them now, right? But it didn't go too well with the seniors, no.
It didn't. I think my husband has done the same thing with Kilimanjaro this summer now, thinking like, right, this is it now, I've broken the curse.
Yeah.
So you spend 40 minutes up there and you have your Mayo epiphanies.
Yeah.
And then is the descent, like, are you coming down with a sense of like achievement or a sense of like, oh, that's it, like there's nowhere higher to climb now?
Yeah. What I found was, I describe it in the book, what happened was, I got a bit cocky, and I remember the golden rule is to be clipped in at all, clipped in onto a rope at all times. You're never, ever, ever not clipped on.
And where are these ropes? These are attached to the mountain?
They're attached to rocks, anchors, whatever in the mountain, right? So that obviously if you slip, it'll save you. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, there's a bit of swagger coming down and all of that type of thing. But there'd be ropes from other years that might be lying loose.
Okay.
And might be torn, the winter might be whatever. So I lost my focus or concentration, and I discovered then that I wasn't on the correct rope, and for something. I ran my eye along the rope ahead of me, and it seemed to be going over an edge.
Oh Jesus!
And I pulled it, and there was no resistance. And I just got so cross with myself. I describe it in the book, and I was so angry with myself for being
But does this mean that you had moved away from the group, or?
No, there were just, it was an idle rope.
But like the rope you should have been on was maybe parallel to it, or was...
Correct.
Okay.
And
but you were still with your group.
Basically, what happens is you get to an anchor and where the clip runs down the rope, you get to an anchor. But you're also, you're doubly clipped on, so that even when you're changing, even when the clip is off, you put it on the other side of the anchor. And if anything happened in that moment, you're still clipped on.
To the other one.
To the other one. And you're still going to be safe. But then, anyway.
So you're really annoyed with yourself.
I got so cross because that meant that because I knew there was a bit of pep in the step or whatever you call it. I had a serious, serious talk with myself. Yeah. I focused from there on. And the fright I got was something else. Like, I want you, you know, the usual expression, but anyway.
Yeah. Your pants that you've been wearing for a month that I've been watched.
Yeah, the underwear was bad enough. Yeah.
So you just clip on immediately to the correct one.
I found the correct one and I made sure I at the anchor. It had to be at the anchor that I picked up the incorrect rope. And I'm not sure I was on the correct one from that point onwards. Yeah.
And then you come down to camp four again.
You come down and you sleep.
Right.
And you sleep. But do you sleep? You're so tired. You really are tired at this point. And you sleep so well. Because all through the training, anytime I trained, and you would say you're pushing your body for strength and you're trying to get stronger and stronger and stronger, and all the time, no matter what I did, I always trained so that my return, you use mind games. In training, you use mind games because you're going to push yourself as hard as you can. And then, but in my mind, I always ended up, no matter where I was, be it Nathan or Lugnacola or whatever, I'd always camp for. Was my end result. It was never the top.
Okay.
It was always
getting back to camp.
Return to camp. Yeah. So that was my mind game. And so eventually we returned to camp four. And we slept very well.
And that's it then? Like,
well, then you wake up the next day and you load up your rucksacks and you make it down to base camp.
Come down in one day. Right, okay.
Yeah.
And what's that like returning to base camp? Like coming back down?
Returning to base camp is basically we went down through the Kumbo Icefall is a massive experience.
Are you going up the same way you come down, or do you?
Correct. You go up and down very similar routes.
The same route. Well, and are you meeting many people? Like, how many people are doing this?
Wow. I'd say at base camp, there could be maybe 200 people at base camp. That'd be including the Sherpas and the cooks,
right,
and the whatever.
These are people who've come up and that's their destination, or people from base camp who are leaving to go to the top?
The numbers that would continue on would be smaller.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Like, base camp is a destination in itself.
Yes.
It's just a wonderful experience for if somebody wanted to do that.
But I'm just thinking about,
totally,
like,
recommend it.
When you're coming down the mountain from the summit, yeah. Like, if you're coming down the same route you go up, are you meeting people in traffic? Like, are you meeting...
Oh, what's the traffic like? Yeah. It can't... Basically, when we did it towards the end of the window. And that turned out to be very beneficial because a lot of people had left the mountain at that stage.
But the window?
The window might be 4 days of good weather in which you can summit.
Oh, okay.
Outside of that 4 days, it's probably impossible to summit.
But if it takes a month to climb the whole thing,
yeah,
how do you know that when you get to the summit, it's going to be inclement weather or not? Like, do they have really good forecasts or?
Satellite.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So they know what's coming.
The information, it's all information. It's like the lads that sail around the world now. That'd be in, obviously, there's so many huge challenges that exist, you know, the great challenges of the world, you could call them. But they use satellite now, and their safety is so much increased as a result.
Yeah, because you can imagine, like, when Edmund Hillary was doing it, like, they were doing it blind.
They hardly knew where they were going.
They hardly knew where they were going, yeah.
They were feeling their way. It was totally unexplored. And they just didn't know what was up ahead of them. And like, I mean, it's and their clothing wasn't nothing by comparison to now.
They didn't have their North Face gear on.
No. I don't know how they did it.
And well, a lot of them didn't make it. I mean, he did, but many haven't. So then you get back to base camp, and like, how do you come home? Like, how do you go back to Mayo from from the summit of Mount Everest and be satisfied with your life? Like, is there something gnawing at you that's like, I need something else now, but there's nothing more that you can do? Or do you have to do it again? Or do you just feel satisfied? Like, I did that. That's the end of that.
I'm trying to think of the singer songwriter. I think he's an Australian guy, and some guy in an interview says, what's it like being a has-been? And he says, it's better than not being, or something to that effect.
Right, okay.
Or never have been. No, you live off it. It's an incredible positive, because it's sort of...
I'd say you dine out on it a lot. Like, it's just a great thing to drop into a conversation in public.
Well, I'm here.
Yes, yeah. That time I was at the top of Mount Everest.
Yeah. And then you pretend to be all modest about it and blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? You're not allowed to boast, really. Not in Ireland, are you?
No. They'll put you right back on top. Yeah, like I did, saying you didn't do anything for Sam.
Kick the Mayo guys. Yeah.
So then you've written this book, Beyond the Summit, the story of one man's need to scale his inner Everest. Was the idea for the book, did that come to you on the mountain, or was it afterwards that you were processing everything, or how did the book come about?
Wow. I picked up some writing as I went along as a hobby or an interest, or see if it was just something I could do. And then after, it was a natural thing to do then to sort of write a bit about Everest. And a lot of what I had previously written was about growing up in Mayo and when we were down in Australia, and just things, places we were and experiences I had. And then I wove the climbing of Everest through that. So the climbing of Everest would be about a third of that. And come and go. What I tried to do, I started off with high up on the mountain. And what I tried to do was to bring the reader, as they start the book, basically Camp 4. I wanted the reader to come into Camp 4 and be in the camp, ready to strike out on this journey with me. And then I would reminisce, and I would think about things that happened in Mayo, things that happened in Indonesia when we were down there, and different places. My mum, she had this symphoniotomy operation, and I write about that and the effects that I try and get through, describe the effects it had on her life, which is, it was a terrible, terrible operation to have. And that was done under the auspices of our government and our church. Then I'd write about my dad. He passed away, and he died on St. Bridget's Day. And when I got to the top of Everest, I had a St. Bridget's cross with me. And I left that there, as well as my Mayo flag. That was my, my quest. My quest was the Mayo flag and St. Bridget's cross.
Do you think the Mayo flag's still there?
I'd say it's a bit shredded now.
Yeah, they all get shredded, don't they, from the wind.
Yeah. But the image is powerful. When you see it up there, the old green and red, and the image stays the same. The image in your mind does not shred.
Just standing there singing the Saw Doctors, hoping for the best.
Yeah. Take me home, yeah.
And so what's next? Like, is that something that's a box ticked, or do you still have that drive to push the body?
This November, if everything works out, I'm going to do a Dublin. And
what's that? Where is that?
It's a mountain on quite close to, it's 7,000, just under 7,000 metres, and it is nearby, we'll say nearby Everest. Okay. You go in the same direction from wherever.
So you might see the flag in the distance.
I'll bring a pair of binoculars.
Do you bring a Mayo flag to all the summits? Leave them there?
I left one at Chaw Yu as well, in Tibet. Yeah. And I was very happy about that.
Littering male flags around the Seven Wonders of the World.
Yeah. It fits in well with the prayer flags. The old green and red fits in well with the prayer flags up there. Yeah.
Subtle.
Yeah.
And so you'll do that in November. And so that's under 7,000. So you don't need, or just over, you don't need the oxygen.
There'll be no oxygen. Well, basically, one of the things is I believed that during the a virus, the hospitals in Nepal were quite short of oxygen and in the COVID-19 pandemic. So I don't think I'll climb anything that'll require oxygen until further notice.
People don't need it to stay alive. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So that's my book. We didn't get to talk much about the book, but maybe some other time.
No, you can tell me about the book. I can tell people it's called Beyond the Summit, the story of one man's need to scale his inner Everest, and it's by Kieran Lally. Where can people get it?
They can get it in Eason's and all the small bookshops.
Which is the bigger achievement, to have written the book or to have climbed the mountain?
One led to the other, so I don't know if I'd have a book published if I hadn't climbed the mountain. But it's easier to climb the mountain.
Yes, as someone who's written a book, I mean, I haven't ever climbed a mountain, but I don't even like walking uphill. It's a tough thing.
Yeah, and then you sort of you try and get it published, and writing it is one thing, getting it published is a whole other story.
Whole other story, yeah.
And that is eventually PJ Cunningham at Ballpoint Press saw something in it, and his wife Rosemary, and that was very rewarding for me that he ran with it. That was a bit of good fortune.
Is your wife still into the adventure and the hiking, or she?
Well, we love going on the Camino every so often.
Oh, yeah.
And we then, a few years back, we went down to, and we did Mount Ararat below the far side of Turkey, out in Kurdistan. And that was under 5,000 meters. And we had a lovely time down there. The height suited her. The altitude sickness kicks in around the 5,000 meters on her.
Okay.
Her body will not acclimatize beyond that 5,000 meter mark.
And is there any way of knowing whose body will react in different ways? Because I know that was one of the things my husband was saying. He's like, I don't know how I'll acclimatize. Like, I'm fit, I've been training, but the altitude affects everyone so differently.
I believe there's tests you can do. You can do blood tests that they can analyze your blood and learn a lot about your ability to acclimatize by analyzing your blood. There was a group of British doctors, I believe, that were up in Everest, and they were taking samples of one another as they
went up.
Yeah. And they examine that when they got back down to the lab.
I leave you with this question. Do you think anyone can climb to the top of Mount Everest within reason?
Within reason, I think most people, most things are achievable. I'll try and be a little bit deep here. Guided by the mind, the body is capable of achieving extraordinary things.
So it's less about the physical training and all about the mental training of it.
I wouldn't underestimate the physical training,
of course,
but I wouldn't underestimate the mental aspect to it. The mental aspect is powerful.
Which a lot of people probably do underestimate.
Sports psychology now is so, so big.
It's
massive. Like, I mean, I don't think many people will learn anything without sports psychologists. I'm talking about the big boys now but the psychology of the thing is absolutely, of any of these things, any of these great challenges, it would be massive.
So you need a sports psychologist and a Sherpa and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Kieran Lally, thank you so much for joining me. That's Beyond the Summit. If you're looking for it, you can get it where all good books are. Yeah, if you want to read about a Mayo man who left a Mayo flag at the top of Mount Everest, I highly recommend that you do. You have listened to another episode of Basically. Our music is by Only Ruin. Our graphic design is by Cathal O'Gara. Julie Hassett is our producer, and we are part of the Headstuff Podcast Network. Thank you so much.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.